Welcome.
My name is Tom Arthur, and I am the leader of the Duke Socratic Club here at the Divinity School. The sponsors for tonight are the Duke Socratic Club, the Duke Divinity School, Duke Chapel, the Navigators, the Interfaith Dialogue Project, and we have an anonymous sponsor tonight who's helped make this event happen. Our speakers tonight are going to be introduced by Dean Wells, who is the Dean of Duke Chapel. And so I'm going to hand the microphone over to him now.
Thank you, Tom. Our two speakers tonight, on my right is Dr. Gary Habermas. Dr. Habermas is Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy and Director of the MA Program in Apologetics at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. He's done extensive research and writing on the topic of the resurrection of Christ and is author and editor of over 27 books on the subject. Professor John Marcus on my left teaches New Testament with an emphasis on the Gospels in the context of early Christianity and first century Judaism. Jewish by birth, he's been a Christian for the past 30 years, and I'm pleased to say an Episcopalian for the past 25. It's the same thing, I know. But we're not here to talk about that. The relationship between Judaism and Christianity, therefore, is an issue of existential as well as scholarly interest to him. He's written two monographs on Mark, an impressive two-volume commentary on Mark, and has also published a collection of Good Friday sermons entitled Jesus and the Holocaust. We're going to start with 10 minutes from each presenter on the opening question, which is this. What degree of history and theology are reflected in the different New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection? I'm going to read that once more. What degree of history and theology are reflected in the different New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection? Dr. Marcus.
Thank you. Well, let me say up front at the beginning here let me start with kind of a personal confession. I came to the study of the New Testament because of what I believed to be encounters with the person whose resurrection we're talking about tonight. And I still believe that. So I am not coming from the same place in this discussion as the professor I heard about once, a very theologically and politically liberal professor who was fulminating about the rise of the Christian right and who said, you know, was talking about people like Pat Robertson and Tim LaHaye and Jerry Falwell, and he said, if Jesus could hear the things these people are saying about him, he would turn over in his grave. I probably heard that wrong, right, Gary? I've heard that before, yeah. That's probably an apocryphal story. If we had time, we could analyze its historicity and try to see what the kernel of truth is in it. But we won't do that. We're here to talk in this first section about the degree of history and other things in the accounts of Jesus' resurrection. And I think that if one does believe that that event took place, especially if one believes that it took place, one cannot still ignore the historical questions that are raised by even a casual glance at the New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection. And these accounts involve us in this larger subject of the relationship between the New Testament and history. And my main contention is that the New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection are no different than the other accounts in the New Testament, that they are a fusion of historical memory about what happened to Jesus with the faith and experiences and insight of the later church. And I think that even, for example, the Gospel of John presents this idea of the fusion of the memory about Jesus with the later insight of the church. When Jesus in John at the Last Supper says to his disciples, look, you can't bear, you can't understand what I'm saying now, but you will understand when the Paraclete comes, when I'm raised from the dead. So I think that John is presenting this basic insight that what we have in the Gospels, the Jesus who speaks in the Gospel, is both based on a memory about him, but also the later theology of the church. And so, for example, I think that there probably are real experiences behind the accounts of Jesus' appearances after he was raised from the dead in the Gospels, but these accounts have all also reflect the distinctive theology of each evangelist. So, for example, in Matthew, Jesus appears on a mountain. That's not by accident. And it's not by accident that he gives commandments, because throughout Matthew's Gospel, Jesus is presented as a new Moses, and Moses also, of course, went up on a mountain and gave commandments. In Luke, similarly, he appears on the Emmaus Road, and he says these things about the scriptures and how they all pointed to the suffering and passion of Christ before he entered into glory. And this theme of Jesus as the fulfillment of scripture is something that you see throughout Luke's Gospel from the very beginning. And similarly in John, in the Doubting Thomas story, which is filled with the themes of seeing and believing, which have been major themes through that Gospel. So that isn't by chance. There are memories of Jesus behind these accounts, but they have also been shaped by the views of each of the evangelists and by their insight, they believe, led by the Spirit into who Jesus is. Or to turn to the stories about the empty tomb. Now, in contrast to Dominic Crossan and others, I think that they do rest on some sort of historical foundation. Though I also think that belief in Jesus' resurrection would still be possible if the empty tomb narrative was shown not to be historical. After all, in the Gospels themselves, the empty tomb generally doesn't itself lead to belief. It's the resurrection appearances. And the empty tomb by itself creates as much confusion and doubt as it does certainty. And after all, Paul, in his summary about the resurrection the facts that point to it, doesn't even mention the empty tomb. Whether or not he knew about it, I think, is a debatable question. But I do think that there is some historicity to the empty tomb narrative for a variety of reasons. It's linked with Joseph of Arimathea, who I think was only remembered because he was associated with the place where Jesus was buried. And I also think that, in general, the Gospels aren't making things wholly up out of thin air, that there is usually some sort of memory behind what they're telling, and that that memory has been elaborated. So it seems to me that there is some basic historicity that we're dealing with here, but all of the Gospels have elaborated the story about the empty tomb, again, in line with their own insights. They can't all be historically accurate because they disagree on the details. Who comes to the tomb? Was it one woman or two or a whole bunch of women? You know, there's different answers given to them. A whole bunch of women comes there. Yeah. Who do they see? Is it one angel or two angels or no angels, as in John, but just Jesus himself? And especially, why do they come to the tomb? They come in Mark and Luke to anoint Jesus' body, but in Matthew, they just come to see the tomb. Why do they come to see the tomb in Matthew? Because Matthew, and Matthew alone, has a guard at the tomb. And that is one element that I cannot conceive is historical, the guard at the tomb. And Luke himself tells you, really, the reason that the story of the guard at the tomb is there. It's there to counteract the story that is circulated amongst the Jewish opponents of Christianity, who are saying that Jesus stole the body. So I think that's why Matthew and Matthew alone tells you about a guard at the tomb. It's an apologetic device to defend the faith against those who are saying that Jesus' body was stolen. And I think as historians, we have to say that that is a possible explanation for Jesus' body not being there. It's possible that his body was stolen. It's possible that the disciples stole his body, though I think there's also some disadvantages with that explanation, because at least some of them then were willing to die for what they knew was a fraud, if that explanation were true. But it's at least historically possible. It's also possible, as has been mooted, you know, for centuries really, that Jesus didn't really die on the cross, but he was in a state of suspended animation when he was taken down. That's possible too. It's also possible that the gospel's own explanation is the true one. And I think that as historians, all of those are possible explanations. And that really to decide between them is where faith comes in. And that's basically my position. Have I come in under 10 minutes?
You come in.
I can sing a song now.
That's right. You're at 9 minutes 50 seconds, so that is admirable. Dr. Habermas.
Okay. Well, unlike Dr. Marcus, most of my interest has been in Paul's work in his in the epistle, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I often work back to the Gospels, and let me tell you why. One of my lifelong projects, beginning with my doctoral dissertation too long ago to remember, has been to chart where scholarship is on this subject. I'll tell you why I start there. Where scholars are today does not determine or prove anything. In fact, I don't think anything proves anything, but how's that for a sentence? I don't think charting where scholarship is today proves anything, but I think charting where scholarship is today is a helpful starting point. So beginning with my dissertation, which was done way back in 1976, a number of years ago I decided to update my bibliography, you know, a good thing to do from time to time. And I try to get together virtually every published source is a very difficult thing, but try to get together, let's say, most sources on the resurrection of Jesus published between 1975 and the present in French, German, and English, and then to chart where scholarship is on 100 subtopics, 100 sub-questions. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of discussion. In fact, just plotting where scholarship is has taken me about 600 pages worth, and I still have a lot of plotting left to do. Because there's always new works coming up. Now, I say this because I think a good place to start is where scholarship, left, right, and center, concedes territory in common. And again, that doesn't make it true, but it's a good dialogue point. And more importantly than where scholarship is across the board is why scholarship is there. So I'm interested, I kind of gave the two reasons in reverse. I actually put more emphasis on the first one. Why are these things accepted this way? And secondly, what are these things that are accepted? Because scholarship can change, perhaps easier than some of these reasons do. Now, having started with that, where scholarship is, I like to kind of set the table historically and move from Paul backwards to the cross, or if you prefer, the cross forward to Paul. But if the cross is, let's say, ground zero, and let's just, for lack of a better year, put it at 30 AD, although that's very difficult to determine. And if Paul writes 1 Corinthians about 25 years later, we have about a 25-year period here from this seminal passage in 1 Corinthians 15, really all 58 verses, but I'm really interested in verses 3 through 11, and especially 3 through 7. And Paul says in verse 3, that he passed this material on. It's the third time now he says this in 1 Corinthians, twice with the same words. He said, I have given to you, I have passed on to you the same material that I have been given. And then he starts this passage that is almost unanimously held to be a creedal or tradition or confession, and there are different kinds of those, but a text that he said he receives from somebody else, and he said Jesus Christ died for our sins according to, he actually says Christ died for our sins according to Scriptures, was buried, rose again the third day according to Scriptures, and appeared, and then here comes a list. Now, scholars are not agreed as to whether Paul's citing one creed here or more than one, and for sure he tacks on his own appearance at the end, which would not have been part of that creed. Also, the comment about the 500 remaining alive until the present, largely thought to be Paul's addition to the creed. But Paul's citing material here that he says he received. Today, the most popular response in the critical community to when Paul either got this formalized tradition or the data on which it was based says that most likely he received this material in the Galatians 1:18 or following discussion where Paul goes up to Jerusalem. He says he's got his conversion. He said, God revealed his son to me. And then he says, I didn't go running up to Jerusalem and to meet with these elders, the apostles. But for 3 years, he was by himself or preaching or something. He's not real clear. And then he says in verse 18, he says, 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem to meet with James, the brother of Jesus. Peter and James, the brother of Jesus, stayed with him for 15 days. And in the context, he's talking about the gospel. And it's thought by scholars, the second popular view, by the way, is that he got this at Damascus a few years earlier. But the most popular view, and that's helped along by the view that there's two other individuals besides himself whose names in that list, James and Peter, and both of them appear here too. That's a bit circumstantial. Well, then Paul makes another trip to Jerusalem 14 years later, he says, Galatians chapter 2, just a few verses later. And he says in Galatians 2:2, I set before the apostles the gospel I was preaching. The King James English here is really interesting. He says, to see if I was running or had run in vain. I was setting this gospel before them to see if they would add, subtract, you know, multiply, or divide. He says in chapter 2, verse 6, they added nothing to me. And then in verses 9 and 10, they gave me the right hand of fellowship. Now, at this meeting, you have the same two who are there at the first meeting, Peter and James, their brother of Jesus, and now he adds John, who was there 14 years later. Now, whether this is the same passage as Acts 15, scholarship is not agreed, but could be the same. So, Paul's argument is, I met Jesus, I went up to Jerusalem 3 years after that, I went back to Jerusalem 14 years later. And critical scholars have been taken with this timeline, and they've been fairly impressed. Whatever you make of this, this is probably the main reason why scholarship thinks a sentence something like this would be true. And Dr. Marcus has already, I think, alluded to this. They would agree to a sentence something like this. The early disciples had experiences which they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. That's a nuanced comment. But this is where this comes from. The idea would be that Paul himself claimed to be an eyewitness of such an experience, and then he's talked to others who tradition says were there in various capacities too when they show up in the list in 1 Corinthians 15. Now, the interesting thing about this is this is not some move that conservatives make or something like that, but pretty much across the board. For example, Garrett Ludeman says that he dates the formalization of the 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following confession, he dates it from about the time of Paul's conversion, so he thinks it predates the Jerusalem trip. The Jesus Seminar colors, this is interesting, with their red beads, pink beads, gray beads, black beads. As some European scholars say, only in America could you vote on Jesus' words. But anyway, in their Acts of Jesus, what did Jesus do? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9:1, am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord? In 15:8, he says, last of all, he appeared to me. They color that red. And again, that's not because anybody in the Jesus Seminar I can't speak for them, but they're not saying the resurrection happened. They're saying Paul reported that it happened. He had an experience which he believed to be the appearances of Jesus. The first appearance is to Peter, and they color that pink, and the explanation, which is probable. And their explanation is, we don't get it from Peter, we get it from Paul. If we got it from Paul, it would have been red. If we got it from Peter himself, it would be red. But since Paul is repeating this creed, it's, you know, still a good report. We'll call that pink. And then in their comments, they add the women, too. The women, too, regard a red or pink, require a red or pink ranking for Jesus appearing to the women. So this is the Jesus Seminar, and they date the formalization of this creed to before Paul's conversion as well. The latest estimates are from James D.G. Dunn, who says that the creedal passage was formalized by 30 A.D., and more recently, Larry Hurtado, who likewise said that this was formalized by 30 A.D., and he adds that there never was a time when the New Testament church did not preach Jesus and his resurrection. So I work with this timeline as a starting point. It seems to be where a good deal of scholars are today. And then we kind of go back and fit details. For example, Dr. Marcus has already alluded to one good question. Was Paul aware of the empty tomb? And that, you know, that's a good point here. But on this timeline, it's a nice starting point for me anyway, because so much in the ancient world, we have nothing like this. I mean, we rarely have something that comes down from such short periods of time, even 25 years. I think of the best-known biography of Alexander the Great being written 400 years after the fact by Plutarch. And here we have Paul talking about something 25 years later, and he was there, and he knew some of these people. So that's the framework in which I begin working on this.
Thank you very much for the opening contributions. The way this is supposed to work is you're supposed to imagine that the three of us are having a conversation in a bookshop and you're overhearing it. So you're the books. There's now going to be opportunity for Dr. Habermas to ask Dr. Marcus some questions.
We're going to interact a little bit. What are we going to do with this?
I'm going to do whatever we do.
Very good. Okay. Dr. Marcus, let me ask you a historical question here. If we concede that, or you can differ if you want, but if we concede that the disciples had experiences, some early Christians, let's say, had experiences which they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus, in your opinion, can we say that, just go up?
Yeah, kind
of. Can we say, in your opinion, that this event we call resurrection, as nearly as you can tell, is this a description of something that happened to Jesus, or is this a more experiential event that happened only to the disciples?
Thanks, Gary. Why don't you repeat the question?
If we want to concede, I said, or not, that the early Christians, at least the ones whose reports we have in the New Testament, believed that they had experiences which they thought were appearances of the risen Jesus, and we affirm resurrection in some sense, would you tend to say that the historical data are something which point to this being an event that happened to Jesus, or an event which was largely experiential, and we could say, you know, in Bultmannian or post-Bultmannian terms, this is an event that the disciples alone experienced?
Well, if I understand what you're driving at, which I'm not sure that I do, I mean, it seems to me that what we can say historically is that the disciples believed that they had seen the risen Jesus. So they believed that they saw something about Jesus. But the historical question, so we can say something historically about what they believed. I don't think that we can say anything historically about whether or not they were right. I don't think that's an historical question. I think that's a matter of faith.
Okay, so we can't get behind their testimony then?
Not historically. I don't think that we can get behind their testimony historically. You know, I don't think that that's the historian's task, to try to decide whether or not, you know, some sort of experiences which are really in the spiritual realm happened to them or not. I think we can say that they, well, that at least some of them believe that those experiences happened and that that belief was transformative of them. But I don't think that that gives us ground to stand on for affirming the truth of what they said. I think there are grounds for affirming the truth of what they said, but they don't rest on a historical weighing of the veracity or lack of veracity of their testimony.
Okay. So if this is to be determined by faith, I guess then I would maybe move to a philosophical question, and maybe this isn't what you're saying, but if you could clarify, in what sense would faith clarify anything? Faith is something we do. Let's take in marriage, we say I do when we're convinced that we want to spend the rest of our lives with somebody. So decisions like this are based on, we would say, you know, good data. We know this person. But what can faith alone establish if we don't punt to a historical conclusion, as best as we can determine it? We're not talking about proof here, but as best as we can determine it.
Well, I don't think that faith establishes anything. I think faith is something that gives one a ground for believing that something is true, which by nature one can't prove. And it comes about through an inner conviction about something that nobody can refute, and I don't think that anybody can establish in ways that are convincing to others who aren't already convinced about it, to others, you know, who have not had that same experience. So, I guess that's what I'd say, basically, is that you can't convince anybody about your faith. You can testify. You can say, this is what I have seen. You put it out there, and then you let somebody accept it or not. And it seems to me that that's what Christians have been doing for 2,000 years. My turn. Okay.
Oh, good. Well, this is a lot more fun. I guess I'm kind of still fixated on the tomb. So let me just ask you what your opinion is about one of the things that I said, and that was this provocative comment of mine about the guard at the tomb. Do you agree with me that in terms of historical probability, it's probable that that didn't happen the way it's described in Matthew, that there was no guard at the tomb?
Okay, now is this also on the larger question of the tomb or not?
No, just the guard. I just want to know about the guard right now.
I think the guard's a very tough question. I think you point out good reasons for that. It's mentioned in Matthew alone, and you said that Matthew mentions that for obviously apologetic purposes. I guess, Dr. Marcus, I'd pull rank here a little bit. I remember one of your reviews. You reviewed a book, and you said, hey, so-and-so has apologetic reasons for this, but apologetic reasons don't mean it's not true. I would say
that's true in this.
Well, okay, if your next question would be, okay, on what strictly historical grounds could we? I'm not sure we can. I remember an article William Lane Craig did years ago, I think New Testament Studies or something, where he did a bunch of pros and cons on the guard of the tomb and decided it was a toss-up in totally historical terms. I don't think we have anything that I would say, oh, here's 14 evidences for guards at the empty tomb. I wouldn't go there. I think it's difficult to come up, and like I said, Bill came up with this pro con and left it there. But I wouldn't use it as part of my, for example, earlier you said we have these ifs, ands, and buts in the gospel accounts. If I use my methodology and I start with things that scholars have in common, Certainly the guard in Matthew's tomb is not, so I would not make use of it anywhere in my apologetic. Maybe I'll just answer your question directly. I don't think it can be solved. I don't think that question can be solved by evidence's pros and cons, historical arguments.
Okay. I mean, if, you know, considering the evidence for it, if it was historical, why, what possible reason would there be for the other gospel accounts to leave it out? Why did they miss it if it actually happened?
Seems to me that would be a question similar to any one gospel having an account and the others missing it. Either they don't think it's part of their motif, or they're not privy to those traditions. So there's a couple of reasons. Maybe they don't think it plays a very big role in what they're saying. You do have all four Gospels citing the empty tomb. In this survey I've done of scholarship since 1975, these various scholars have come up with a list of...
I'm not asking you about, you know, the empty tomb.
Okay.
I'm talking about the specific question, because I guess I want to get at, you know, sort of your hermeneutic for evaluating the historicity or lack of it in the gospel accounts. And I'm just wondering if you're willing to go with me in affirming that some of the things that are affirmed in the gospel accounts as having happened perhaps didn't happen. And I guess what I see is that you're not comfortable in admitting that.
And I'm not seeing specific reasons why I should cast it out. If in fact that having an apologetic motif invalidates something historically, then I don't think it does. I still think the question is it accurate? But I don't have, like I said, five arguments for and against. I think that was the point of Bill Craig's article.
I guess we have time for. I guess I did want to ask you, you know, perhaps, you know, less confrontational way. Though I don't think that was confrontational. It was a friendly argument amongst scholars. How about Paul's lack of mention of the empty tomb? Why do you think he doesn't mention it, and does it possibly indicate that he doesn't know the tradition about the empty tomb?
I think it's possible that Paul does not know the tradition of the empty tomb. I also think it's very possible Paul does know the evidence with the empty tomb. I don't think we know enough to say either way, and maybe that's why Paul never mentions it. I do think something worth mentioning here, that even John Dominic Crossan or Marcus Borg both say that they think it's an entirely possible scenario that the sequence of dead, buried, raised, kind of a what went down is what came up, even in their estimation, is difficult to pull off in a Jewish context without Paul knowing something, or Romans 6, buried with him in death, raised with him in his resurrection, would be difficult enough on a Jewish framework to pull off without belief that something happened to the body. But to say, first of all, 1 Corinthians 5, the creed is not even Paul's word, so it's somebody else's testimony. So if you said, give me a chapter verse on Paul, there's nothing like that in his epistles.
Okay, but then it's possible that the creed that Paul is employing there in 1 Corinthians 15 also doesn't know about the empty tomb narrative.
It's often said that the earliest kerygma, if it had valued the empty tomb on the level of the appearances, it would have had it up there in the creedal statements. The only one that comes close is what you do with the so-called speeches in Acts, the small kernels. And in Acts 13, you have the report that Paul does report an empty tomb. Now, whatever you do with secondary data, so-and-so says Paul reported, but that's not the epistle. That's not Paul. So I agree with your earlier statement that the early belief in resurrection was founded on the appearances, not on the empty tomb. The empty tomb, I think, is very important, but I think the appearances are more important. I think it's very clear from the New Testament. I think it's very clear in current scholarship.
Okay.